Good morning.
My name is Travis Stearns. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Ross, and I'd like 3 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. I think it's important to start this conversation with the closing arguments of the state and to the court when they said that the crux of the evidence of the firearm possession was the evidence of the assault. And at no time during this trial, at no time at any point, was there ever a suggestion that there was a separate gun, that there was a second shooter, that there was anything other than one continuing incident. When the jury issued its final verdict that Mr. Ross was not guilty and that they did not possess the firearm, that became, I think, the point at which the court was collaterally stopped from issuing a contrary ruling. So what I want to talk about today are those two issues. First is the collateral estoppel issue, and then second, this issue, which hasn't been addressed before, I think, in Washington State, which is the inconsistent verdicts, and that this, I think, also not only was the court collaterally stopped, but this was also an inconsistent verdict. To find...
Well, the elements are different. Why was the court collaterally stopped?
Well, the elements are different, but there's the element of... you're right, the elements are entirely different, but the facts are exactly the same. The disposition of the arbitration of all of these facts are exactly the same, and the assault involves the use of the deadly weapon.
But here you have the trial court in a bench trial.
Yes.
Relying on the evidence that was presented to the jury, but applying the evidence and facts that the court found to different elements. So why does collateral estoppel of the jury verdict come into play?
Well, and again, I think that the issues, while I do think, I mean, I appreciate what you're saying, that the elements are different. I think that the issue is exactly the same. The issue put before the court, and it's like Ash, which is the case that really discusses this, there are two different victims, right? So in the initial trial going forward in Ash, you have victim A. They bring the trial not particularly well against victim A, and he's found not guilty. And so then they say, well, we're going to go forward on victim B. And the court said, no, that's a violation of double jeopardy. And, of course, those are different victims, and so therefore obviously different.
What happens if instead of waiting until the jury verdict is published, the trial court announces its decision?
I think then that you don't have this problem at all.
So it's just who talks first?
I think that the way that we normal or the, my experience at trial court with these is that the court generally adopts the findings of the jury, and I think that that's the appropriate way to go forward. But I do think that yes, if
you're telling us that the judge has to adopt the findings of the jury, how is it a separate finder of fact? I mean, aren't you just saying really we've got one finder of fact and you just tag along?
Well, certainly.
And using that as a device to keep the jury maybe from hearing some evidence that you don't want it to hear?
Well, certainly that's what I think it's Galloway says, that the jury is the final arbiter of the facts, yes. And I think that that's the...
Well, is that in the context of a judge and a jury both hearing the same evidence?
Yes.
And charged with different decisions?
That's in a very similar, it's not a firearm case, but it's in a very similar situation as this, yes, that when they're sitting in a bifurcated trial, Galloway is a bifurcated trial, and there's evidence that's excluded for similar reasons. And
you know, this isn't a concept that's unique to the criminal law, and collateral estoppel in a civil case, you oftentimes will have cases that are involve issues of law tried to a jury and some equitable issues that the judge decides. And you're telling us that if the judge doesn't decide the equitable issues first, the judge is bound by the jury's decisions on the questions that presented to it?
I wish I were better at civil law, but I will say that Marbury, which is another case that addresses the same sort of question that I think that you're asking, is yes, that if the issues have been decided by a jury like they have here, that the judge would be bound by it. I think that...
But it sounds to me like, maybe correct me if I'm wrong here, but it sounds like what you're saying is that collateral estoppel arises from how the prosecutor argued. That somehow the judge is bound, you know, that since the prosecutor, you're saying, decided to argue it, that this was the same firearm, and that the die was cast at that point. Nobody could. The judge couldn't. Nobody could do anything else except either accept the prosecutor's argument or reject it. But that isn't right, is it? I mean,
no,
the judge
that's
is
not
a
right.
fact finder, and the judge is hearing the evidence, and there's no previous decision that forecloses the judge from saying, based on the evidence I heard, there was this firearm was possessed by this person. Whether he ended up shooting it at the guy or not, I don't know, but just on these facts that I'm called upon to decide, there was evidence that supported that prior to the actual shooting, which may or may not have been the cause of the person getting the bullet, prior to that, this defendant, this victim, I mean, did see the person possessing the firearm.
Ash again.
So different issue.
I think that Ash again guides us here and says that you really have to apply rationality and realism and not to adopt a hyper-technical analysis. And I really think that that's important to say, yes, there is this possibility that some other gun was there. There is this possibility that that happened.
Well, are you arguing or not that the thing that binds the court is the prosecutor's
absolutely
argument?
Not. No, absolutely not. I don't think that that's...
okay, what does
it all?
If it's not the fact that the prosecutor argued it that way?
I think the final decision of the jury that he did not possess this firearm is what binds us, and then the case law, which says that the court should be applying rationality and realism.
The jury found that he did not possess this firearm.
Well, certainly then when they found, when they issued the deadly weapon, or they endorsed the deadly weapon enhancement saying that he did not possess the firearm, they certainly said that did not happen during the course of this assault. And then if, again, you can say there, I mean, I think that if you apply a hyper-technical analysis, there is some possibility that there is some other weapon out there. You can do that. I think that
entirely
possible. But
the court made specific findings. So are you arguing substantial evidence does not support those findings?
I did argue sufficiency as well, but I think that this case really does rest on the issues of collateral estoppel. And the other issue, which I think is important, is that this court should not allow the inconsistent verdicts to stand.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Ann Summers on behalf of the state of Washington. I wish first to address the collateral estoppel and inconsistent verdicts issues, which in my mind are very intertwined, so I'll address them together. And then if I have time, I'll address the sufficiency of the evidence as to the firearm. I'd like to make 4 points in regards to collateral estoppel and inconsistent verdicts. First, there is no collateral estoppel in the absence of relitigation. Second of all, collateral estoppel would not apply here anyway because the issue before the jury and the issue before the court were not identical. Third, for the same reason, these two verdicts are not inconsistent with each other. And fourth, even if they were inconsistent, under Washington law and federal constitutional precedents, inconsistent verdicts are not a basis for reversal. There is no collateral estoppel in the absence of relitigation.
And what case says that?
Ash, Yeager, Moy, those are all cases in which the state was precluded from having a second trial in front of a new jury.
But what I'm asking is, you're making that as if it were a holding that would be reflected in the headnotes. You know, there is no collateral estoppel in the absence of relitigation. Is there a case that says that sentence?
I'm arguing that if you look at...
Because otherwise you're asking us to, in a very fraught area of collateral estoppel and jeopardy, to write a sentence that will hereafter be quoted. And I'm not sure that the law really says that, unless you want us to hold this for the first time. There is no collateral estoppel in the absence of relitigation.
I think if you look at the collateral estoppel language...
Yes or no?
In those
I mean,
cases,
there is no case that you have that has that sentence in it.
That there is no collateral estoppel in the absence of relitigation.
Right, that says that in so many words, so that you could write it down and go to the bank with it.
I can't cite it that it's stated in that word that way, but there are no cases, either in Washington nor in the U.S. Supreme Court, that have applied collateral estoppel in the absence of someone trying to relitigate the case.
That's different, isn't it? There hasn't been a fact pattern that supports that, but that's different from making that utterance and saying it can never happen. Because it hasn't happened yet.
Well, I think for two reasons. If you look at the explanation of collateral estoppel, it talks about relitigation. It talks about cannot present the issues again.
But
So it's inherent.
Let's just use our familiar elements of collateral estoppel, then. Maybe you want to proceed to point two.
Well, can I ask?
Which was what?
Is there a case that approves an inconsistent decision by a judge and a jury in the same case, hearing the same evidence in one trial?
Knight from Connecticut, the Supreme Court of Connecticut, which I cited. It's the exact same situation. And they said there was no exactly what I'm saying. There's no collateral estoppel without relitigation. Second of all, even if collateral estoppel principles apply here, which, again, I say they don't because there was no attempt at a second trial, the issues weren't identical. It's not like Moy. In Moy, no one saw Mr. Moy with the gun. So the only evidence of his possession of a gun was the shooting. And here, Mr. Jones testified to spending, I believe, several hours with Mr. Ross before the shooting happened. And the jury took pain, I mean, the court took pains to explain its verdict and how it was not inconsistent with the jury's by saying Mr. Jones could well have had an inaccurate memory of the actual shooting because of his traumatic brain injury, and particularly his account of where he was sitting when he was shot was inconsistent with the trajectory of the bullet. But the court found very credible his evidence of being with Mr. Ross in the hours leading up to the shooting, which is when he saw him with a gun. And this was corroborated by witnesses seeing Ross's car there at the time of the shooting. It was corroborated by Ross admitting that his car was there at the time of the shooting. The fact that Mr. Ross and Mr. Jones had been smoking crack together in Mr. Ross's car was corroborated by Ross's statement to the police that when they searched his car, they might find a little bit of crack cocaine.
Could I ask you this? The jury verdict had the special verdict form question, was the defendant Howard Lee Ross armed with a firearm at the time of the commission of the crime in count one? Now, the first question was, did he commit the crime in count one? And they answered no, right?
Yes.
Okay, I don't understand why that question was asked of the jury in that way, instead of saying, if you find that the answer is yes to the first question, you must proceed to find whether he was armed with a firearm. Because why would they even consider this question?
I think that's right. I looked carefully at the instructions because I thought perhaps the jury hadn't followed their instructions. I don't think the jury should have even been instructed to answer the special verdict unless they had convicted.
Okay, so I didn't think they should have
either,
but they did answer it.
They were not instructed in that way, and they did answer.
Now, he's arguing, appellant is arguing that is the foundation for collateral estoppel, because at least as I understood the argument this morning, it was that was the finding that he was armed not with a firearm, but with the firearm that the state was accusing him of possessing.
That's wrong. If you look at instruction 14, the jury was instructed that the state must also prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there was connection between the firearm and the crime. Having already determined that they could not find beyond reasonable doubt that Mr. Ross committed the assault, they could not have answered yes, that there was connection between the firearm and the assault, because they hadn't found the assault. So this is not a statement from the jury that Mr. Ross never possessed a firearm on that date. It's a statement that Mr. Ross did not commit an assault with a firearm, which is completely consistent with the court's finding that she gave credence to that verdict, and that verdict stands. It's in no way nullified.
Well, did the jury instructions separately address the special verdict, though? So, in other words, you know, typically we say, well, we look at the instructions as a whole. But here, if you just have the instruction related to the special verdict, mm-hmm. then the instruction you're relying on may not relate.
So there was a standard concluding instruction,
right,
which didn't have anything, from my view of it, anything special about, you know, when you go to the special verdict. And then there was an instruction that said the state must prove the special verdict beyond a reasonable doubt. And then there was the instruction 14, which gave them the
So in this case, instruction 14 would be part of what they would need to look at.
Yes.
Which is different than many other cases.
I think it's not the best way to instruct the jury. I think that they should not, my understanding is they don't reach the special verdict.
It's the law of the case in a way.
Well, and I'm happy with it being the law of the case, because the law of the case is simply the jury found that there wasn't a firearm. Mr. Ross didn't use a firearm in assaulting Mr. Jones. That does not preclude the court from finding that Mr. Jones' testimony was very compelling, corroborated, and, you know, also...
Well, it's such a weird finding, because he didn't use the firearm in assaulting Mr. Mm-hmm. Jones. Well, he didn't assault Mr. Jones.
Exactly.
Found. So, I mean, the idea that you would then say, and when he did assault Mr. Jones, he didn't use a firearm. I mean, it's kind of the implicit inconsistency in not between the two verdicts of the two fact finders, but within the jury's own verdict, there's an oddity. There is a...
Yes, they couldn't have answered yes.
Yeah.
And if they had answered yes, it would be a nullity anyway, because you can't have a freestanding firearm enhancement.
But the ambiguity is cured by Instruction 14.
Yes. Yes.
So it's not something that we need to focus on separately. We need to look at Instruction 14.
So one thing I just want to point out, that the court found credible was Mr. Jones' demeanor when he was describing his delight in riding around in Mr. Ross's car, which apparently was quite the sports car. And she just found it very, very credible. And that's not inconsistent with saying Mr. Jones had a memory of being with Mr. Ross, being with Mr. Ross and a gun, but the actual circumstances of the shooting that put him in a coma was something he did not have a good enough memory of for the state to get over the hurdle of beyond a reasonable doubt.
You had two other points, and I have not written them down, so I wonder if you could reiterate them so that I can...
Well, so the other point is, for the same reason that these are not identical issues under a collateral estoppel analysis, they're not inconsistent verdicts either. An inconsistent verdict is more of a due process question. But more importantly, inconsistent verdicts are not the basis for reversal. That's clearly true under both Washington law and U.S. Supreme Court case law when you have inconsistent jury verdicts.
And you don't concede these are inconsistent.
I don't concede they're inconsistent.
So what is this? Just even if they are,
like, it's
even
my
if
alternative,
they are?
Alternative argument. You know, we like
last
to argue full
all
layers. Just in case you don't believe this, there's this. But I'd also point out Harris versus Rivera.
I think that's how they put the jury instructions.
Yeah, exactly. Decide them all. And Harris versus Rivera, the U.S. Supreme Court said that there was no constitutional problem with inconsistent bench verdicts either. So if there's not a problem with two inconsistent jury verdicts, and there's not a problem with two inconsistent bench verdicts, then I believe there's no problem with inconsistency if there were one between a jury verdict and a bench verdict. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I know that the credibility isn't really the significant issue here, but I do think that it's important to remember that Mr. Jones' memories were triggered by the $250,000 settlement that his aunt reminded him that Mr. Ross had gotten, and that it wasn't until after that settlement that he happened to remember that Mr. Ross was the man who assaulted him. And I think that there are significant, beyond the memory impairment issues that he has, there are significant reasons to credit the jury's verdict here. And I think that when you rule in Mr. Ross...
How do you address the argument that's been made that the jury had to take into consideration Instruction 14?
I think that those also could have been better drafted, and I do.
Doesn't Instruction 14 answer why the jury came to the conclusion it came to
on the firearm charge?
Yes.
Yeah, I found that to be very odd as well, and not the right way to do things. It would have been much cleaner, I think, if they had not been asked to answer that question, and I don't think it was necessary to the resolution of the guilt or innocence of him. It would have been a better instruction set if that had not been that way, yes.
But you're relying, you phrase it as, you said the jury made a finding that he wasn't armed with the firearm, but
yes.
That isn't even what the special verdict says. It says he wasn't armed with a firearm.
Well, I'm sorry then.
It was the firearm, you'd have a better argument, because you would say the jury found that, you know, he didn't have He didn't have the firearm.
I really think that
he's alleged of having in the killing.
There is no other firearm. I don't think that there is any suggestion ever.
There are a billion firearms in the world.
There are a billion, and again, that's the kind of vagaries that Ash says. I'm sorry, hyper-technical analysis that Ash says you shouldn't engage in. I mean, it is entirely possible we never went to the moon, and we should also not engage in those kind of vagaries.
I don't think that's all your metaphor, because the thing is that. You know, the jury, there was a trajectory issue, right? I mean, that was one of the things, is that the jury may have just had a reasonable doubt about whether Mr. Ross fired the bullet or whether there was some possibly person, you know, a phantom shooter out there somewhere.
Yeah, it could have been a phantom. You're right. I can't say that it wasn't a phantom, but that was never evidence presented of a second shooter or of a phantom or anything else.
Well, was there evidence presented that your client sitting in the driver's seat of the car could not have shot the victim and had the trajectory that was shown by the evidence?
I'm sorry.
That the bullet must have come from someplace other than the driver's seat.
I think that the argument all along had been that it was Mr. Ross and that it was not another person.
Defense didn't argue about the trajectory.
No, that there wasn't. The defense did not argue that there was a second shooter or that there was some other person involved. They argued that this was not Mr. Jones' testimony was not sufficient to prove the case. This was not a forensic science case. This was a credibility case. I know I'm out, but I would just ask you to read Galloway in addition to Knight, because I think that that's an important case on the relitigation issue, and just urge you to read that one in addition. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. All right, we're going to take up next Simmons versus Microsoft.